welcome everyone. You all are like a minute and 3 seconds early, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Would you like coffee with donuts?
Please.
Just a plain donut for me.
Half with milk.
I'll talk to my cousin, maybe he'll bring one.
So just in case you're wondering, the Facts Over Fear is our website and sort of social media campaign, and we have webinars and stuff to counter anti-Muslim bigotry, and that's available on YouTube, but also you can find all of it on that website, Facts Over Fear, just a single page. And then the PAS network is we're trying to figure out how to scale what we do, and so we have a distance learning platform and a community conversation piece on that network. Because one of the things that Paths to Understanding will be focusing on next is trying to help communities that are growing in their religious diversity to begin multi-faith partnerships or to expand them in smaller towns because Western Washington, for instance, is expected to grow by 1.5 million people in the next 30 years by 2050. And that means a lot of the small towns that are currently predominantly white and Christian are going to have a lot of different diversities within them. And if we can help get some partnerships started and help people understand that their neighbors are assets and not competitors, you know, always, that we can, I think, have a more peaceful 2050 than we would have otherwise. And then, of course, as we think about climate migration likely to increase, I think the number will be higher than 1.5 million. And so how can we begin to help prepare those communities for that kind of, to embrace their neighbors and to be embraced by their neighbors?
Because so we know Washington will never get hot like California.
Your confidence inspires me. So welcome everyone. My name is Terry Kylo, and I use he/him pronouns. And we're going to be exploring once again Jesus' leadership within the first century culture through the lens of Jesus as an ally. And I do just want to go back, go back where we ended. This is an image I always like to show, and kind of forgot to do that yesterday, of Mary and Martha and Jesus. And you notice that Mary has a book in her hand. Of course, it is a perfect bound book, which would not have existed at that point. But what you notice, if you could see it a little bit, if it's a little brighter, is that both Mary, Martha, and Jesus all are haloed. Uh-huh. Which is an artistic way of saying, and please excuse my potty mouth here, they are badasses. Mary and Martha are badasses. That can sometimes, help us recognize their agency and how revolutionary they were within their own context. So I want to remind us once again that in the Lutheran Church we talk about life in terms of being fully affirmed as God's beloved, and so therefore we are free to change. So learning and changing and growing and being disturbed, being disoriented, seeing things in a new way is not to move away from our tradition. It is, in fact, a deep and perhaps even a core part of our tradition. So one of the ways that Luther talked about this kind of change is that he said that when we engage Scripture together, when we read it together, we are encountered by God through law and gospel, or what queer theologian Mary Lowe would say in today's language might work better, is that we're humbled by that word, and then we are also empowered by it. And those happen together, and they happen in different ways. So one part of us, one idea in us may be humbled, but another part is going to be, so it's a very complex process, right? That I think again speaks to this kind of, because we are beloved, we get to change. So learning and changing and growing is not to resist the trends to our tradition, it is to embrace the heart of it. We live in a time where human beings are pretty much able to determine what kind of information they get by what news sources they take in. Your Facebook feed, if you have one, is specifically designed by algorithms for you so that you will see the things that you want to see and you will not see the things you do not want to see. If you watch a YouTube very much, and once a while back I was working on a deck, I had a little deck problem I wanted to fix. I started looking up how to fix decks. Pretty soon you would think everybody in the entire universe is fixing decks all the time, and that's all that they are, because the algorithm feeds you more. So if you happen to look up something on the issue of race, and you click on a video that has some white supremacist notions in it, pretty soon you're going to get more of it, and you're going to get more of it, and you're going to get more of it. And so we live in a time where confirmation bias is like technologically built into our information structure. Our tradition is in part built to help us recognize that we have confirmation bias and give us a perspective with which to challenge it. To say it is okay for me to challenge my concepts, in part because my identity is based on God's love for me and not on the correctness of my theology or economic approach or whatever. So today, and so what I would like to do today is take us through the parable of the talents, in part because to function as an ally for people who are being actively oppressed, one has to have a perspective about the institutions and structures and sort of the spirituality underneath those institutions and structures. And I believe that Matthew 25 allows us to see, encounter some of Jesus' approach to understanding his critique of his of the Roman Empire and the way things work. So would someone please read this rather long passage, I know, so take your time, but would someone please read it out loud?
For it is as if a man going on a journey summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded with them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, the one that had the 2 talents made 2 more talents. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents, saying, Master, you handed over to me 5 talents. See, I have made 5 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And one with the 2 talents also came forward, saying, Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Then the one who had received the 1 talent also came forward, saying, Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. But his master replied, You wicked and lazy slave, You knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one with the 10 talents. For to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
So let's continue to use our process here. I've got to slow down because I did strain my calf last night. So we use a process where we're going to talk about what interpretations we have heard or ourselves have held about this passage in the past, and then we're going to put those away, and then you can all have them back at 10:01. So what have we heard about this text before?
It's good to be a capitalist.
Uh-huh. What else have we heard about it?
Use your talents or gifts.
Yeah.
Or else.
Or else. Yes. The Darth Vader voice really helps me out.
Some are more talented than others.
Uh-huh, yeah. That is very interesting. We'll come back to that later. Yeah, so this passage is pretty much utilized to talk about using your gifts, right? And then it is, I think, often, I mean, I've heard many people use it to say, well, this is Jesus saying that, you know, laissez-faire capitalism without, you know, much regulation, neoliberal economics is, in fact, authorized and approved of by Jesus, right? I mean, that is, and it's used in stewardship sermons, you know, we should use our talents and not bury them in the ground and all that sort of thing. So let's put these away for a period of time. And if they are dear to you, that's okay, because you can have them back. And would someone else please read this text? And then let's underline or sort of think about the words or the phrases or the names or whatever that we think is important if we were to do, like, anthropology into the first century and see what's going on here. Who'd like to read?
For it is as if a man going on a journey summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. And then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, the one who had 2 talents made 2 more talents. But the one who had received 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of these slaves came and settled accounts with them. And the one who had received 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents, saying, "Master, you handed over to me 5 talents. See, I have made more, 5 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master." And the one with 2 talents also came forward, saying, "Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master." Then the one who had received the 1 talent also came forward, saying, "Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours." But his master replied, "You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one with 10 talents. For to those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Thank you. Some of those words are hard to read. They're hard to say out loud, aren't they? So what are some words or phrases or just stuff in that text that we want to know more about and explore together?
Bankers.
Bankers.
Entrusting property to slaves.
Uh-huh.
I want to know where the guy went for such a long time. Uh-huh.
How did the slave know that he was a harsh man?
Mm. I want to know what they were trading.
Why did the master give 5 talents to some and then this poor schmuck gets 1 talent?
According to their ability.
What were the interest rates or what have you?
Mm-hmm.
Typically.
I will confess that I do not know. No one's ever asked that before. That's fascinating. That's a great start. Anything else?
Curious about reaping where I did not sow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is that? What is that getting at? Mm. Interesting. Did I just hear a thief?
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Who is the master represent? What do you think? In most of our life, in Bible studies or sermons, who does the master represent, do you think? Have you heard?
Huh? God.
Yeah, interesting. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, so we'll explore that. So there is so much here. and I want to make sure that we spend a little extra time today getting to our own situation in our own time. So I want to make sure we get to that. So it was typical for people who were very wealthy to offer to slaves their property in order for them to make more money. Because slaves had no honor rating, right? They were outside of the normal like ranking for hierarchy in the day. And in the peasant economy, according to the social science commentary folk and others, in the day, they understood that there was the economic pie was only so big. And so to trade was to take what belonged to other people. And as I said the other day, the only way to get wealthier with a kind of, without being called a thief, would be if your flocks increased or your crops increased. Because God is in control of your flocks and your crops. Now, fishing, I think, also would be included in that. And there's some other, but I'm offering some simplistic entry points here. So in the peasant notion of the economy, there is only so much around. It's a zero-sum game. If I get more, you get less. And so what people of high honor rating would do is that they would put other people in charge of their money to do the dirty work for them, and then they could just say, well, hey, my slaves did that. That wasn't really me, you know. And they could get all of that. So the man going on a journey, I would propose that the man going on a journey is not God. Because that would presume, in a way, that Jesus, a Jewish theologian, is proposing that God is first of all a man, and that number two, that God has left the building. Does that really make sense? I don't think so. And now, we often assume in the story that the protagonist of every story, the main kind of most powerful person in the story, is God, which we might want to pay attention to, our proclivity to do that. Why is it that we always think of God as as interacting with or being represented by those with the most power. That's actually quite an interesting assumption that we kind of make there. And we might want to think back to like the Magnificat or other stories at the beginning of Luke about where is God showing up. But we'll talk more about that in a bit, perhaps. So he summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. And then he went away according to his ability, right? And so how much is a talent? A talent is 75 pounds of gold. It would take 6,000 daily wages to equal a talent. So most people, and the lifespan, of course, at this point in history is not that long. You know, 34, 35, maybe. I mean, you know, I would be ancient. In that, I would be aged. I would be like, wow, how did you do that, right? How did that happen? Yes, sir?
I want to challenge that idea.
Yes.
I hear it many times.
Yes.
If the average age is 45, it means that one person lives to be 90,
yes,
and one dies as an infant.
Right. So I think, I don't know if I said average or median. I think most people, you know, died around their 30s and 40s, according to a lot of folk. But there were people who lived to be quite old as anyone today.
70 or even 80.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. But the lifespan was not great. I mean, there's pretty good statistics, for instance, on infant mortality.
Yeah.
You know, right? And the note and the idea is that that something like 20% of children and mothers died in childbirth, and then another 20% died before the age of 6, and another 20% died before the age of 12.
Yeah.
Right. So mortality rates were quite high. But I'm just trying to say that over a lifespan of earnings, most people are not, average workers are not going to see a talent. So it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely huge. So it's a lot of dough. The one who received the five talents set off at once and traded with them and made five more talents, which in the peasant theology and economics of the day meant that other people lost five talents. And the second did the same, but the third one buried it in the ground, which I think the interpretation I've mostly heard is that he therefore hid his talent. And of course, where did our word talent come from? For like, I can do things. That comes from this text. So America's Got Talent, right, came from this word, this biblical word. That became our notion of capabilities that people have that are seen as gifts, you know. That's where that word, you know, came from here. And so maybe I should start to say the money talent or the currency talent, you know, right, to try to make it clear. But he buried it in the ground. Now, according to the social science folk and many other biblical scholars and archaeologists and anthropologists, it was quite common for the poor people of the day when they went on a journey or they were trying to safeguard money to bury it in the ground. In fact, if you came to me and said, hey, I'm heading off to Jerusalem to Passover this year, would you please, you know, take care of my money for me? And so you hand me, you know, your 6 denarii, you know, that are your kind of, you know, savings account or whatever. What I would do is I could either keep it in my house, in which case I would be responsible to pay you back if I lost it. But if I take it out and bury it in the ground, actually, God is responsible at that point, because what's in the ground is God's domain. And so burying it in the ground is actually quite a normal thing in that culture. And so then we come back to the judgment, right? So the master is gone for a long time. And notice it starts off, for it is this a man And then now it's master, right? So the master, I gave you five talents, I gave you five more, I gave you two talents, I gave you five more. And then he says to them, well done, good and trustworthy slave. You've been trustworthy in a few things. I put you in charge of many things. Enter the joy of your master. Part of that text, by the way, is in the Episcopal funeral rite.
Yeah.
Well, good, thou, you know, a good and trustworthy servant. Every time I read that, I about choke, because I do serve in Episcopal context sometimes, right? And so, master, I knew you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. What do you all think that's getting at? I think someone said it earlier, too.
You're a thief?
A thief. That's what a thief does. If I come into your garden and I take your zucchini in August,
We say thank you.
Right. But if I took your tomatoes in early July, you might not feel the same. If I come into your garage and we reap the tools that I did not purchase, if I come onto your land and steal it from you, what am I? So this is an accusation. Did the master take offense at the accusation? What does he say?
You knew, did you?
You knew that.
Yeah, you knew it. It's true. I accept the critique. In fact, I'm all about it. Woohoo! You knew that I was a harsh man, reaping where you did not. But his master said, you wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow, that I am a thief, and gather where I did not scatter. In Hebrew sort of theology and storytelling, you know, part of a way to emphasize a point is to say it multiple times in a row in different ways, poetic ways. So that's like an exclamation point, you know, hashtag, you know, all of these little things going on. Quotations, bold, italic, you know, everything you could do typographically, be like 18-point font or whatever, and blue and flashing. That's what that tries to do when you have that kind of double. Yes?
Could it also be that he's just turning the logic of the slave against him, saying, oh, so if that's what you think, okay, then this is what you get as a result of that thinking?
It sure could. But remember, this is not a story that happened. Who tells the story? Jesus is telling the story in Matthew 25. One of the challenges that we have sometimes, I think, when we read a text like this is we think, okay, this story happened, like the parable of the Good Samaritan, like that story happened. And we get all into, you know, the dynamics. And some of that's important to look at. But Jesus is telling the story. And immediately after, Jesus tells another story about the great judgment. Mm-hmm. Right? And we'll just explore that for just a minute before. So, I mean, I think that's the way you're thinking is, I think, really awesome. Because you're like digging in, you're doing that anthropological work. But we got to remember that Jesus told this story, he's telling it for a reason. And Matthew record, you know, puts the story down at the end of Matthew, right before Jesus is going to be heading off to the cross. And who is it that crucified Jesus? The Romans crucified Jesus. So I'll just put my cards on the table. I think this is Jesus' critique of the Roman Empire. Those are the cards are on the table, right? And that the master is Caesar. And the slaves are Herod and Pontius Pilate and Herod Philip and all the leaders out in the Decapolis who were all sending taxes to Rome. Who are stealing from people. By the time Jesus was 11 or 12, only three people owned the land in Galilee, and they were all Romans. And you went to the marketplace in the morning, you stood against the wall, and you hoped that the supervisor of the slaves of property you used to own would come to you and say, you can come and work today, and we'll pay you a denarius to do so. But if you get mouthy, if you don't work hard, If you say something bad against the master or against me, you're not working ever. In fact, we're going to freeze you out. Yes?
Is the use of the word slave here suggestive of the Roman context?
I think that the word slave is used in many ways in that first century context. It generally did not mean chattel slavery in terms of ownership of a person. So one could, a slave, a doulos might be someone who is attached to a family, but who does not have inheritance rights. That is part of it. A slave could also be something like being the steward of an entire property.
Yeah.
It can, in this case, it is being the steward of a huge sum of money. So the phrase is used in many, many, many different ways. And unfortunately, in our history of slavery in this country, they did not attend properly to like how that's being used. So it's a very wide, and it's also used generally like I'm a servant or slave of God. Right, so it's used in lots of different interesting ways that I think are very confusing for all of us. Yes, sir.
I heard that one of the chief translators of the Revised Standard Version resigned because the group decided to translate doulos as servant. And he said it should be translated as slave.
Infinite are the arguments of interpreters. And another one that I wish the NRSV had done differently is they use the word Jews to refer to Judeans, which is a way of like talking about the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem under Roman occupation, trying to fit in and trying not to be beheaded by the Romans. But then they use the term the Jews, and so Jesus says these harsh things about the Jews. But he's not saying it about his race or his religion or his culture. He's talking about the specific Jewish leadership at the time trying to survive under Roman occupation and how they were basically selling out. Some of them were selling out Jesus' tradition and his culture and his people. So I wish the NRSV had changed that. It just burns me every time I see it. So I totally get it. I totally get it. Yeah, so one other clue, I think, that the master is not the God of Israel is in verse 27. So let's just, Deuteronomy chapter 23, you shall not charge interest on loans to another Israelite, interest on money, interest on provisions, interest on anything that is lent. Jesus in Luke 23 says, and if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expect nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and to the selfish. So Luke in chapter 23, Jesus appears to be critiquing the God that we read into Matthew 25. I think it's highly unlikely that Jesus is going to portray a God as asking for interest. Right? So I just think that's really important. So let's talk about the Roman system for a moment. This is the taxation system built into fishing. Remember that Caesar claimed ownership of the water and all that was in it. And so that meant that if you were hungry and you wanted to go down to the Sea of Galilee with a little net and capture a couple fish for your children's dinner, you could not do that. So you had to become part of a fishing syndicate. Let's see, do we have a laser pointer here? I wonder. Oh, maybe we don't. I don't know. So you had to become part of a syndicate. You had to pay a fee to become part of it. You could hire laborers to become part of your work. And then you also had suppliers, and you had boat builders and weavers, and you had farmers who made flax for nets, and you had stonemasons who helped you with anchors. But then you would sell your fish to the syndicate, who would then give it over to processors who would then give it to distributors and shippers and carters, and then over to buyers and sellers. And at every single step of the process, what do you have in the middle? Tax collectors. And the taxes, you know, and again, some of this is a bit murky, right? But Marcus Borg thinks that the taxation structure was somewhere in the 40 to 50% range. And it was incredibly regressive. So the richer you got, you know, kind of the less you were taxed, kind of like Washington State, actually. And then there's a chief tax collector who is in charge of all of those other tax collectors. The tax collectors, like St. Matthew himself, is said to be a tax collector, obviously is not a mid-level broker tax collector person. He's sitting at a toll booth somewhere, working for the Roman Empire, and right, you know, it's pretty bad. And then what would happen is that Herod would then have this chief tax collector, and Augustus, Tiberius, and Caligula, and all those fine folk would receive a good portion of all those taxes. And this is just the fishing one. So what would happen with farming? What would happen with everything else? Olive oil production. What would happen with wheat? Right? I mean, all of that. And so there's licenses that are being done. And then, of course, the fish also go to Rome as well. And the people in Israel-Palestine don't have as much protein from the fish as they might have had before. And so Augustus Caesar and the Caesars in general were a man who went far away and then wanted to hold their stewards, their slaves, in this case, Herod Antipas, right? Or other folk, Pontius Pilate as well, into account and to send the proceeds on. And so what is Jesus saying about the Roman Empire? That it's thievery. Let's go back and read that one more time down below there. You knew that I... Did you that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? So this is Jesus in telling a story, having the master say out loud what the Roman Empire is all about. Basically, the Roman Empire were the mafia with a standing army. Yeah. That's kind of what they were. Now, why didn't Jesus, or Matthew, for instance, the writer of this gospel, and we can think of gospel lessons as kind of like a sermon to the community at the particular point, and we're kind of listening in to the sermon that was given, whatever year it was, in the 70s or 80s, you know, something like that. Who knows? We're everybody's arguing about that as well. So we're listening into that sermon. Why wouldn't Matthew just say, here's the deal, friends. The Roman Empire is unjust. Its systems, its institutions are a bunch of thieves. Down with them. What would happen, do you think, to Matthew and his community had he done that?
Crucifixion.
Yeah. So they're kind of speaking in a little bit of narrative code. And, of course, what's the problem with that?
People don't get decoded.
Yeah, I mean, we have to work hard to try to figure out, okay, what is a reasonable interpretation of this, of these euphemisms? And we're 2,000 years removed from the culture. And so we have to just really, really work hard. And so what happens is we bring our confirmation bias and the way that we see the world, and typically what we want as human beings is for the texts, for God, for the church, for whatever other religious community we're part of, to affirm our basic worldview. Because we're all born into a culture, just like they were born into a culture. And we want to know that the God is pretty much okay. Like, this is the best of all possible, like America's or whatever. And we want to do that. And I can tell you as a preacher, like, the days when I preach on, challenging things about our culture, that's the day when I really sweat. Uh-huh. And when I talked to Rabbi Johanna Kinberg, who would have been with us this year, but couldn't come thanks to the whole COVID thing, and Rabbi and Imam Adam Jamal, whenever we get up here, what they'll always share is that the days when they sweat the most in their sermons is when we take on things in a broader culture, especially economics. Mm-hmm. Because I would argue that our notion of economic theory actually functions as our primary theological system for many people in the world. And the study of theology is not the study of what dead white guys used to say. The study of theology is to critique worldviews and whether they produce the kind of thriving in humanity and in the ecosystem in the world that would be beneficial for everyone. And so when we critique our theology, that's the moment when we sweat. And when we sweat, that reminds me of Martin Luther, who said, our God is what we fear, love, and trust. Whatever that is, that is our God. And so I can tell as a preacher, Rabbi Yohanan could tell as a preacher, and Adam Jamal, the imam, could tell as a preacher, that when we talk about economics, we're actually engaging the real God of the time, at least one of them. So I would argue that that is the primary religion of our time, not Christianity or Islam or Judaism or anything else. And so what Jesus is doing, I believe, and this is a similar passage in Matthew as well, after John was arrested, Jesus came to Galilee proclaiming the good news of God and saying, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God has come near. Repent and believe in the good news. What is the kingdom that the kingdom of God is replacing? The Roman Empire. But what we tend to do in after years and millennia of conversation is to think that the kingdom of God is simply the escalator that gets us up to heaven when we die. So access to heaven when we die is come near. Isn't that great? When in fact Jesus is saying, we do not have to live by the spirit of thievery, the spirit that says, for all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, and again, this is a beautiful poetic way to say something that's horrific. For those who have nothing, I mean, maybe they have a backpack or a shopping cart, or they've managed to find a tent and a sleeping bag, and are sleeping in a park, even what they have will be taken away. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Just having grown up on Native reservations, this is chilling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I experience great pain reading this text. Yeah. I think we should. I think we're invited to, right?
Yeah.
This is the humbling of the text, right? There's a freeing part, of course, is that when the person who hid the talent in the ground is called a worthless slave and cast into the utter darkness with his weeping and gnashing of teeth, well, that's the Roman Empire casting them into the dark. That is not God doing that. From a peasant point of view, the worthless slave is the only one in the situation who acted rightly, who spoke truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
And so in telling the story, who is Jesus speaking truth to? In the narrative theology of our Jewish neighbors, he is speaking truth to power. And Matthew is continuing to tell that story, speaking truth to power in a way that will keep them alive, uh-huh. in a way that will let the message spread very, very thoughtfully. So, what is the actual distribution of wealth in the United States? Most wealth is held by very few people. 0.1% have as much wealth as the bottom 80-90%. We began to see a shift, a tremendous shift, in wealth and income and disparity around 1980, where, and this is, of course, a few years old, and these statistics are always a few years old, and I'm trying to find an updated chart. But somewhere around 2013, 2014, the wealth of the 0.1% began to overwhelm. And we're seeing huge amounts of wealth and income inequality. We have seen that in the United States, somewhere around 1972, 73, we began to see the hourly compensation began to level off, all adjusted for inflation, while productivity of the average worker in America increased by 241%. Where did that money go? Probably there, right? Part of that is based on education. What does it take to get an education now from a debt perspective? Tremendous amount of debt that people have to do. And so if you have a bachelor's degree or more, your salary rate goes up. If you have a high school degree or less, your share of earnings goes down. If your family cannot afford to help you, you might choose not to. Or we might, as sometimes happens in this culture, glorify one type of work, let's say IT work, and not lift up the fact that plumbers and welders and woodworkers and builders and all kind of caregivers in all kinds of settings. I mean, we could go on for a long time, right? That those are not as good. We don't need those, but well, we obviously do. And so they feel left out. But it also happens in terms of race. The gap among high earners. This is among physicians and surgeons, interestingly enough. This study just came out. That white men who are physicians or surgeons receive an average of $63 an hour if they're white men, and they receive $46 if they're black women. That's among really educated people. That and a plethora of other things leads to a different set of life expectancy. White men, average of 75.5, black men, 68.3. There's no biological different reason why those should be different. So this is really challenging, this story. So where was Jesus leading in this story? And where might he be leading us? What do you all think? And before you answer, let me say, I think that it is okay for us, as long as we don't walk too far down this Puritan road, that you are what you do. It's okay for us to encourage us to someone to utilize their gifts for the good of humanity. I think that's okay. You know, it's good for us. I mean, Bonhoeffer, he said that when you have members of a community that don't have a role, don't have an opportunity to offer something to the community, it's going to break the community down. So it's good to invite people in, as long as, of course, we're not reducing human beings to what we produce and consume, or in the church to what we offer in one way or another. Like, there's lots of different gifts that people bring. And we often monetize them. We sort of turn them into we reduce them to monetary or other kinds of critiques. So we don't have to take away everything from the text that we may have seen earlier in order to understand it this way. And I'm not saying this is exactly right. I'm just saying this is what I've come to in my own life. So what do you think Jesus might be saying to us in this text for us, for in terms of our leadership in the world?
Well, I can tell you what a very, very wealthy friend of mine got from this, is that God helps those who help themselves.
Of course.
And he truly believes that.
Sure. Yeah, I've had many members of congregations, people who participate in Bible studies, say the same thing. This is Jesus' blessing. God helps those who help themselves. And so, you know, again, we have tremendous desire to justify ourselves. Remember on Monday we read the parable of the Good Samaritan. And what did the lawyer say? What did the text say about the lawyer? And to justify himself. But and so what I would, you know, where I might start with someone in that situation, if I was in personal conversation, might be, well, do you believe that human being, that your worth is determined by how much wealth you have? What is it that determines your worth and your value? Because to go on a full-on attack on that person and say, you're wrong, you're a thief, you're a this, you're a that, like, that's maybe not going to be the most helpful right thing. So do you think that your worth and value is determined by how much wealth you have? And if so, you are such a loser compared to Bill Gates. You are such a loser. Loser, 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 loser. Right? And start to have a little fun with that, right? You know, so, I mean, only if this person can take the joke a little bit, right? So is Bill Gates worth more? Well, no. Okay, so what is it? And then start to peel that apart. Because if we can get to an identity, I think that's the part of the beauty of the Lutheran tradition is that we believe that it's not just that our sins are justified. We're not justifying sins. Luther was clear about that. That ourselves, our being, our existence is justified by the Creator who loves us as we are. And so therefore, how much money we have does not justify our existence or not.
But I do think there are some in this world, and I as a woman, I hesitate to speak for men, but I do think, as I speak of my father's own identity issues and my father-in-law's identity issues, it's not so much that you are valued by how much money you have, but how well you can provide for your family.
Sure.
And so I can see how that can get twisted as well.
Right.
And then that becomes then the burden on
yes.
all of us who are called to carry the gospel to say
yeah.
your value is not necessarily in how well you provide for your family, but that you are a beloved child of God.
Right, so this is where, I mean, so somewhere in here, I mean, a lot of things are good that can hook us into things that aren't so good. So, I mean, as a male person, I do take very seriously providing what my family needs. Like, I take that very seriously. And when I resigned from the church that I was serving, the churches I was serving to start Neighbors in Faith, I didn't know where my money was going to come from. I had $5,000 from the synod. I had $5,000 from the diocese. I had no other. And I actually had a promise from one person to offer me $5,000 a month. And I realized that person did not share values that I could stand up to. And I had to cut ties with that person, which meant that I was entering into a time when I did not have money for my family. So food is good. Give us this day our daily bread is really good. And so I think the desire to work for that is good. You know, in the Hebrew scripture, you know, after the man and the woman, you know, they're encouraged to till the earth, you know, and provide for daily bread. So this is not a disrespecting the work or the desire to facilitate one's family. The question is the larger economic and theological system exploiting that good desire in a way that actually leads to an unjust society, in a way that actually deforms human beings into, instead of providing for the daily needs of their family, to get into competitive status keeping based on how much wealth we have. My brother owned a boat. It was a 64-foot boat. Mm-hmm. It was a yacht. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful inside. You walk in, it's like walking into a very nice, I mean, very well-appointed living room. And had a king-size stateroom, and had a queen-size little stateroom. And on the coffee table, what do you think was sitting there?
Bible.
Boat magazines. Yacht magazines. And what would happen is invariably we'd go on the boat. This is a very beautiful boat, you know. It costs like $700,000. Right? Or more, right, really. And boy, you know, that boat is really cool. And then as we're driving out of the marina, what do you think? Wow, that's an incredible boat. I wish I had a boat like that. And what do you think the people who have the 100-foot yacht would say? What do they have on their coffee table? Yeah, so desire for this kind of competition and status keeping, and then the people that have the 150-foot yachts, they're doing the same thing because their yacht doesn't have another yacht with a helipad on it. And they don't have, like, original Monets in the guest room that is rarely used because it doesn't have a bathroom by itself.
I wonder here, and that's a great story, and I'm wondering here if there's a little bit of hope in this passage in that the person who gets the one talent puts it in the ground, gives it to God, and sort of opts out of an unjust system.
Yes.
Although there is a price for that. I mean, in the end, this poor untalented schmuck, it gets the weeping and gnashing of teeth, but at the same time hasn't really participated in harm. So it's almost a carbon neutral kind of an investment strategy. Maybe Portico, what Perth was trying to do,
right?
You know, all that kind of stuff. But I'm trying to find any element of hope in this passage.
Sure. And so one other element, so I want to build on that because I think that's beautiful, is maybe Jesus is the third. I mean, maybe Jesus is sort of saying that there's a movement building where we're not going to participate in the unjust part of a system, while at the same time we need to have daily food and bread for folks. And so we can start to adjust and change some of those institutions and structures so that more justice can take place. And we see that happening in lots of different ways. Sometimes it's faux. Sometimes it's just, you know, show. But like I was talking to one of the people on the leadership team of Mod Pizza. One of the values of Mod Pizza is the idea of a second chance. So they are very happy to welcome in folk to work in that organization and to have a capacity for learning and growing folk that have been in prison or unhomed or have had some other kinds of challenges. Well, you know, so I'm sure Mod Pizza is not perfect. But I appreciate that they're taking this kind of an approach, an analysis, and saying we don't have to live like this. Yeah.
Is there a reason that we end it there? Is this what, there a reason?
Yes.
I'm kind of new to reading the Bible.
Yeah,
do we
yeah.
end it there for a reason? Because the next line says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory. And then yes. it ends up going to who stays and who goes. So
yes.
I don't know why it ends there. Because the next part talks about the people who didn't feed the least of us
yes.
go to hell.
We're going to get to that. So okay. part of the reason why we do it this way is because we can only have so much in an hour.
Sure. I guess, yeah, but I just, when you read
yeah,
the next
no,
part,
totally.
It doesn't look to me at
totally.
All like the master is doing the right thing.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So thank you for that. So Matthew 25, okay, let's get to this whole thing. I'm working on something on the side here, folks. So let's just move this over. So here's the parable of the talents. Let me go up here and do something that I don't know why it does this to me all the time. So there's the parable of the talents, as for this worthless slave, and then there is a comparison story. Mm-hmm. There's a companion story mm-hmm. about the values of when the Son of Man comes in his glory. It's not when a man goes on a distant journey now. It is the Son of Man. The Son of Man is the idea that God will send a fully human one. That's kind of another way to interpret that word, son of man. So it's like the truly human one. God will send the truly human one to help us all become human. Mm-hmm. And actually in Daniel, there's this beautiful transition where the son of man reigns, and then it says, and they will reign together, or they will reign with him, or what, you know. So there's this like flattening of the power structure into a circle. So the son of man comes and then transforms things, and then what is the main value system when the son of man comes? Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, thirsty and gave you something to drink? When was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison? Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. Who does God identify with in this story? Who's the Son of Man identified with? The vulnerable, right? Is there in this judgment story? And so remember, this judgment story is not literal either. This is a judgment story that's designed to encounter us with humility and hope. Humility and empowerment. So it's asking us to think about our values and how we live them out. And what kind of values are really important to God? What are the ultimate values that we might live a life by? In the previous text, the man going on a journey, Caesar, the Roman system, again, we're not talking about Romans, we're talking about a Roman culture, we're talking about a Roman system, we're not trying to pick on Italians, okay? We're talking about the system, the way the whole thing works and how it gets justified, says, I'm all about thievery. I'm all about getting what I want, and I don't care what happens to anybody else. It's all about power. Who does the Son of Man identify with? With the most vulnerable. And that is a completely different value system that I think is quite lovely, and we've gone over time. So these two stories, I think, together form a critique and a counter-proposal for how human beings can live together on the planet. And even though we are in a system which again tends to lean toward the master who went on a journey far, far away, right, and wants his stuff and wants other people's stuff, we also see in that parable or the resistance of the one who buried it. Because Jesus, even in that critique, I think, I just so appreciate, Becca, Pastor Becca, what you said. I think that even that parable of critique, Jesus is offering a sign of hope. That even though we're captured inside of a system that is unjust, we do not have to live by its rules, at least not fully. That there is hope even in the midst of that critique. And that this, that God's identification with the vulnerable can help transform our way of living together as human beings in every way. So the reign of God, the kingdom of God, is not simply about our theology or about the church, it's certainly not just about afterlife, it is also about politics and economics and how institutions work and our policies and how we treat each other, of course, as well. So thank you for engaging me. You can have all your interpretations back if you wish them. Thank you for being here. I'll be happy to ask that question.